Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Welcome to On the Continent, your definitive guide to the week in European football. I'm Dotun Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Nikki Bandini.
On this edition, after the battle of Trabzonspor, are there any winners in the Turkish Super League? Also, does Italy finally get Black Lives Matter? Or does the defence of its European title matter more? And what's taking Thierry Henry so long with his coaching career? Andy, the scenes at that Trabzonspor match against Fenerbahce were really quite worrying, given the sort of recent history of violence at Turkish football games. I know we'd love to talk about the game, but we can't, can we? Because it's overshadowed somewhat by what happened straight after the game.
Yeah, I overshadowed big time, because after Fenerbahce won 3-2 at Trabzonspor, responding to Galatasaray's earlier win in a 7-goal thriller, you can only describe it as that, at Kazim Pasha. Fenerbahce should have been celebrating that, and we should have been focusing on that, because they stayed in the title race with this late Michy Batshuayi goal to win the game, 3-2. And they did celebrate it afterwards, which is what Trabzonspor fans seemed to take exception to. Now, we've seen all the scenes from the end. You will have seen them on social media and the like. So some fans coming onto the pitch, not for the first time in Turkey this season, as you've rightly pointed out, and attacking some of the Trabzonspor fans, attacking the Fenerbahce players. Brightose Samuel defended himself, Michy Batshuayi defending himself as well, and quite rightly so, and then getting off down the tunnel, some of those fans getting in the tunnel. So you will have seen that, and we'll talk about the very serious fallout from that. But to me, the surprising thing, and this is the sad thing, the surprising thing was not that it happened, but that the game got that far, actually, because there was all sorts of stuff being thrown at the Fenerbahce fans during the game. It was boiling during the game. There's a bit before Enes Bardi scores the first goal for Trabzonspor, where Ismail Yüksük, who's defending the free kick, setting up to defend the free kick, he actually picks up a piece of pyro and throws it off the pitch. It's like, how is that happening during a game?
And I was astonished by how casual it looked, because the referee wasn't in a rush to stop the play.
Exactly.
It really felt like it was left to him as a player to take that responsibility. That was sort of I felt like, I didn't see it live, I saw this afterwards, but I thought, well, this is your first sign that this is descending into chaos, if there hasn't been signs already. Like, you should have better control than that happening.
Yeah, and that's one of Fenerbahce's major complaints, that they didn't feel safe, and that they didn't feel that the match officials protected them.
Yeah, Fenerbahce's president was saying just that, that maybe the game should have been stopped much earlier. However, there was a lot to play for in this game.
Yeah.
And you could understand maybe the referee pulling everybody off if there had been an incident that had, you know, struck a player, for example. But it seemed like, even when you were watching it on the pitch, that it seemed like there was a little bit of needle amongst the players as well, by the way.
Oh, definitely. And I think that was Trabzonspor, and that has been Trabzonspor's line that they have taken. That we were provoked on the day, that maybe Fenerbahce should have celebrated in their dressing room. And these were the decisions against us. I mean, there was leading up to the winning goal, they thought there was an Oosterveld foul on Umut Bozok, which, like, maybe they had a point. They still could have defended it better, by the way. But none of that justifies any of this. And the fact that I think it's incredibly damaging that Doyen, the president of Trabzonspor, and the Fenerbahce social media account, we talked about how social media accounts generally, because it's quite a new thing in football, on official channels, on official club channels, need to be way more responsible. For them to proliferate this theme that, oh, we've been really hard done by. So whatever you saw about their players getting attacked, or, you know, you've got to put it into context, which is ridiculous. You don't have to put it into context. There is no context in which it's acceptable. And the point you were making before, Ali Koç, who's the president of Fenerbahce and, like, the richest man in Turkey as well, he's the huge business empire. He came out and said, what, do we have to wait until, like, a player gets, like, attacked on the pitch? You know, do we have to wait until there's serious harm to a player before the referee says, right, we're going to stop this, or before we say we're going to do something about this? Because if we go back to December, you had the then president of Ankara Gücü, Ferhat Koca, coming on and attacking the referee. And after that point, it was like, right, okay, everyone's got to take a deep breath. We've got to look at what we are as a football culture. We've got to change. We've got to adapt and learn how to take a deep breath. And then 4 months later, you've got this, 3-4 months later, you've got this happening.
Mm.
It's ridiculous. And I think Fenerbahce and Ali Koç are right to come out and say, like, something dramatic has to be done now to change, because nothing is changing.
There's layers of responsibility, and I think that's a situation like this unfolds in layers. And I started off a second ago saying, because I did think watching it was shocking that the referee didn't stop play when there's a flare on the pitch, didn't say, right, we need to deal with this, didn't try to do anything about that. But you can't blame a referee for people storming the pitch. There's a level of responsibility that you can put on the referee, and I think that you could say maybe there were decisions in the game that were wrong, and maybe he didn't have enough control and authority in the match. And certainly in that moment, when the referee's first responsibility should still be protecting players, that's his responsibility to say, hang on, there's a flare on the pitch, we stop. Maybe we even stop and say to the next official on, you need to tell the PA that there's going to be an announcement about this, and if it happens again, the game's off, because that's the sort of steps that we've seen taken in other countries to deal with things like this. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about this on my beat, I guess, in Italy, about stopping games for racism this season, which I know is stuff we're going to get onto. But there's now things written into the regulations about there is a process, so referees don't feel like they're on their own, and that's where you go to the next level of the responsibility.
But it's the same in Turkey. There's a protocol that the referee didn't follow.
Yeah, exactly. And so you go to that, but then you get to, this game is happening at Trabzonspor, and it is their responsibility to steward the stadium correctly. Mm. And it is their responsibility after the game to be the adults in the room and not encourage and inflame the situation, which they have. And I think that's where you sort of keep going up the ladder and say, okay, and where have the Federation taken steps after? As you said, Annie, it's not the first thing that's happened this season. Mm. There's this ongoing picture, and saying, oh, this is terrible, is not a solution. A solution is practical steps that you take to do something to stop it from happening in future. And I think that's where you really have to sort of acknowledge it, because in the end, football fans, you can tell them off, but they're always going to be emotional. You can identify individuals who saw on the football pitch and ban them, and you should, but you're not going to address the root of this problem unless you've got adults leading the conversation at the top.
Andy seemed to be saying that the root of the problem is to do, you know, it's an existential problem about the footballing culture of Turkey. But it doesn't seem that whatever steps were taken, and initially, as I recall, when that referee, and it was a horrific incident, I've got to say, I couldn't watch it again, actually, when the referee was decked by the president of one of the teams in Turkey, that actually, that looked like it was a moment of decision for Turkish football.
Exactly, that's what it should have been.
But did they not ban the games for a while, or ban supporters can't come to the game?
They suspended the Super League for over a week, so there were no games for over a week. So this already feels like the biggest thing that could have happened. And yet, as I said, 3 months on, you've got this happening again.
So if we look at
Fenerbahce's players, they're just people at work.
Yeah,
who are trying to do their job.
Yeah. I agree with that, but arguably, and I'm not taking any different. They've got every right to celebrate winning, but the way that the celebration, they were in the centre circle, the whole team, and it looked as if they had won the Champions League, the way that they were celebrating, you know? And I'm saying, look, just like Nikki said a moment ago, football fans are emotional. I'm not making any excuses.
But are you saying be more pragmatic? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think somebody should have said, look, let's just go into our dressing room and celebrate this, because this is already a volatile environment that we're in. And everything we've said about the pyrotechnics being thrown onto the pitch and everything suggests that, well, look, it's a volatile situation.
But you can't, I think you can, I understand where you're coming from. And I think it's, you know, this is, it's the age old conversation for any sort of victim of a crime, isn't it? Should you have been holding your iPhone in that area? Should you have been wearing a short skirt? Like, of course, like, you can say you could make decisions for your own safety that are less risky, but it's not your fault.
Yeah,
it's not. It's not the fault of someone celebrating a football win that they get people running up and trying to punch them. That's not right.
And now we're at this situation where Koch has said, okay, well, maybe we have to pull out the league. And maybe we have to start in a lower division, and maybe we just have to wear.
How does that help?
Yeah, exactly.
How does being in a lower division
help? And also, how do you do that?
I think he's publicly spitballing there, but threatening to pull his team out of the league when they're on the brink of, you know, perhaps like one of definitely the greatest season they've had in recent times. You know, they could win the title, they could go on and win the Conference League because they're in the quarterfinals there. You know, there's so much going on, and they've got a really good team this season, by the way, Fenerbahce. It's something that it's not as if there's no sporting jeopardy. It's not as if he's trying to write off a bad season or anything like that. When they're on the brink of possibly winning it all, he's saying, actually, there's something more important. I mean, the way he put it, he said, the question is, are we going to die once, or are we going to die every day?
The thing that I just want to dig into on that, though, is like, I understand everything you just said. And I think that's like, being extreme about it is like a position that him taking it could be very profound. And it's one of those things where he's able to do it. As you've just said, an incredibly wealthy individual can say, well, even the money wouldn't necessarily stop us from doing that. But if you're just going down to the tier below, then what's your end game? You come back
up.
No, that doesn't make any sense. Yeah,
that doesn't make any sense. But I think it's really sad. Obviously, this is awful to see in any football culture where, you know, people are going to the game to enjoy it. It's awful. And how you would have felt, I think, as, well, not only a Fenerbahce player, but as a child watching that, I think it would be pretty terrifying.
Shocking.
Yeah. But I think especially after the knocks that the Turkish Super League has taken in recent years. So you look at the amount that which the TV rights have been diminished by. You know, it's in a financial hole. It struggles to project internationally. And this year, you've got this extraordinary title race between two really great teams. And the two games, as I said, the Kasımpaşa Fenerbahçe one, by the way, Mauro Icardi scored two goals, scored an own goal, missed a penalty and hit the post in that game. Busy Sunday lunchtime.
Icardi's box office.
Yeah, I
will always have a soft spot for Mario Icardi, even though he does lots of things that I don't support or approve of.
Well, the own goals, you wouldn't you?
But he's box office.
He's doing a lot. He's earning his money out there. But you look at that, and then you look at this game in which Fenerbahce were 2-0 up and Trabzon came back to 2-2, and then they still managed to find a way for Fenerbahce to come back and win it.
Stay good just, game, actually. It's a
great
game. It's a shame that we weren't talking about that.
Exactly. To stay just 2 points behind Galatasaray. So at this moment, after 30 games, they've got 81 and 79 points, respectively. That is an unbelievable pace. And so you can have a situation where, say, the season goes through to its natural conclusion, you have both of them topping 100 points. Mm. It's absolutely amazing. And this is a season where the Turkish Super League should be saying, look at this incredible title race, which is like, you know, Liverpool versus Manchester City at their best-esque. And in fact, we're not talking about that at all. We're not talking about football.
Will they be able to regain control of the narrative? And more importantly, perhaps, what happens now?
I think that's a really good question. I mean, everything is... we've got a bit of a pause, obviously, with the international break. But at the start of April, we've got the Fenerbahce General Assembly, where they're going to decide what to do. But in the meantime, the TFF, the Federation, has to come up with something big, has to come up with something decisive. Because just in the most remedial terms, those players have to be safe.
I don't really have like a conclusion or solution here, but I do think in all these conversations, it needs to be said, football is downwind of culture. And I think there's something bigger than just Turkey happening in European football, where we are seeing more things recently than we had for a while. Not that without precedent, if you go back through all of football history, but Marseille and the situation with fans throwing bricks at team buses earlier in the year. And even if we want to not pretend that everything in this back garden is in order, the Euro 2020 final, with what happened with fans breaking into the stadium and getting in without tickets, it feels like there has been a general boiling up across Europe with lots of little examples of fans. And again, it's always worth saying it's not every fan, but there is an element of fan behaviour that has got worse in the last few years that I think is not just about the sort of individual games and individual matches. It's something bigger.
On that note, Nikki, I like the phrase, football's always downwind of culture. I think it makes a lot of sense, not least when we're talking about a match, again, that we should have been talking about, between last year's champions in Serie A and this year's, I suppose, presumed champions, Inter versus Napoli at the San Siro. We should be talking about the match, but here we go again. Footballing culture has changed. It has. Over the 50 years I've been following football, there was one period where I just didn't feel comfortable going to football as a black football supporter.
Mm-hmm.
That's changed, certainly in this country. There might be other countries where it hasn't changed, but it seems to have changed to a great extent in Italy. And yet, here we are talking about what happened in the match, nothing to do with football, rather than talking about the football match, which, as I read your article in The Guardian, wasn't a huge, you know, great game to talk about anyway.
Yeah. Was, I think, inevitably a slightly deflated game. Both Napoli and Inter coming off their Champions League exits in midweek, one more expected than the other. But it was a match that, when it was on the schedule a while ago, you thought Napoli defending champions, Inter, who've been on this great run of form, could have been a great occasion. But we've talked about lots on this show all season how Napoli's season's gone awry. Inter, whatever happens in this game, we're always going to cruise the title. They're absolutely running away with it now. So the tension was out of the game. And I think you had two very emotionally and physically exhausted teams after the midweek defeats. But as you're alluding to, the story that has come out of this game, the one that everyone's talking about in Italy, is allegations of racist abuse by Inter's Francesco Acerbi towards Juan Jesus of Napoli. There is a contested version of events. So what we saw during the game was at a certain point in the second half, Juan Jesus went to the match referee and starts saying to him, gesturing towards Acerbi, clearly agitated and suggesting that something's been said. From what lip readers said, could see it was fairly clear he'd Juan Jesus was suggesting the word negro, which is a slightly complicated word to translate from Italian, because in its sort of most literal sense, you could say it's just old Italian. It's all come from Latin, and it's negro is black, and in enough old enough language, you could find it being used in a very neutral way to describe colors and things. But certainly in context, if it's aimed towards someone in a hostile way, in modern Italian, you could certainly say it's analogous in intent to the N-word in English. And since then, we've had this sort of, you know, during the game, nothing is done about it. The referee speaks to them. Game ends. Juan Jesus goes on actually to score an equaliser in the game. And after the game said, he said that was a thing that happened.
What happens on the pitch?
Juan
stays
Jesus,
on the pitch,
tried to play it down and said, you know, this is, you know, things happen on the pitch and it's resolved now. But then subsequent to that, we learned, first of all, this incident wasn't put in the referee's report of the game. So, of course, if he has used racially offensive language, it's incumbent on the Football Federation to investigate it. So the Football Federation has opened an investigation into what was said. Francesco Acerbi then came out and said, basically, he misunderstood me. What he claims to have said, Acerbi, is he said what I said to him was "ti faccio nero," which literally translated again, that means "I'll make you black." That sounds bad, but actually that's one of those phrases that if you translate it in what it's intended as, it's like an English person might say, "I'm going to leave you black and blue." Like it's not actually about skin color. That's a phrase that you genuinely would hear used in a way that's not about that. So that's what he claims to have said. Basically it's more of a like "I'll get you." It's not like a racial phrase. Juan Jesus then comes out on his Instagram and says, "Well, you know, I was happy to leave this on the pitch, but that's, you know, not what happened," basically. And says that what he heard Acerbi say is "vai via negro," which is going back to that word negro again, and "vai via" is "get lost," and translate that word. Again, the translation isn't perfect because it's not directly analogous to, but certainly in context, when someone's shouting at you, "get lost, negro," that is similar to how you would translate, I think, for the N-word in English. So it is without question, I think, at that point, especially because he said it in a way that he'd used nero right before, which is, again, the modern word for black. It is really making it a comment that's about skin color. And it is, I think, unquestionably, if it is truly what Acerbi said, I think it's unquestionably a racist thing to say.
And there will be consequences, or arguably possible consequences.
Well, there already are.
This is the point we're at. I think that Luciano Spalletti with the national team took a very appropriate decision and just said, "You can't be with us right now." So Acerbi had come to the national team and he got sent home from the national team. They've got friendlies coming up against Venezuela and Ecuador in America. He didn't get to be part of those. And now there's an investigation, and I'm hedging everything because I think it's important to, because there's an ongoing investigation. I don't want anyone to hear me hedging and think that I'm defending Acerbi's behaviour, because actually, like, if he said what Juan Jesus said, then I think he deserves every bit of what the minimum ban is, which is 10 games according to the Italian sporting code. And that's a minimum ban, by the way. It can be longer than that as well. So that's what we're waiting to find out, is the result of the investigation. Until we have the result of that investigation, it will hang over everyone.
With or without the results of the investigation, I think that points, you know, just the punishment that Acerbi might be facing points to the fact that there has been a cultural change in the way that this all, I mean, going back a few years, Balotelli, remember when he was at Milan, certainly, and I know he was at Inter as well, but he got a lot of racial abuse, certainly when he was at Milan, I seem to remember, and he was almost crying out, you know, to be assigned elsewhere, I think. And at that time, there wasn't an immediate response as I recall, to everything that's gone on. But now there is. But the question is, to what extent will that ban be imposed on the national team? I know Spalletti's, as you said, made his statement, but the ban, as I understand it, doesn't necessarily transfer to the international game, does it?
Typically, when players are given bans in Italy, they only relate to the competition in which they're awarded. So you even see players get suspensions that apply for league games, but not for cup games. I think, again, this we'll have to wait and see what the verdict is, because I think there are, I think there's a lot of, again, from 10 game minimum ban, there's a lot of scope for it to be more than that. And I think it's really going to have to be a wait and see on what the actual ban is. But I think that the fact that Spalletti took such strong action, I don't even know if strong's right, because I think it's just entirely appropriate action. But the fact that he was decisive and just said, right, you have to go home now, you can't be here.
I think this is a really interesting point, actually, because we saw a similar-ish thing recently with Ralf Rangnick, who's now in charge of Austria. And there were those three Rapid Vienna players who, after they won the derby against Austria-Vienna, they were involved in some homophobic chanting, and he dropped them from the squad. And he just said, yeah, we can't have anything like that associated with the national team. You need to go away, think about what you've done. So I think that the fact that Spalletti and Rangnick have intervened without any direction really from the FA, but as like a personal choice, them saying, we are senior figures in our sport and you have to understand what it means to represent this national team. So it's not of a full disciplinary process, but a sense that if you're part of the national team, you have to be seen to represent certain values.
Yeah.
To me, that feels like quite a step to have these two incidents in, or these two reactions by two quite senior figures in the European game in quite a short period of time.
Yeah, and I think that even Spalletti hedged some, because he's been asked about this again since, and he, you know, he said he described Acerbi as un ragazzo bravo, a good lad. You know, he did try to sort of say that, but he made the decision.
But this is different because obviously Acerbi's denying this, whereas these three players can't. Yeah.
Again, I think it's just a responsible way to be, actually, as an international team manager. You don't have all the evidence, all the facts yet, but in the meantime, you don't want there to be any possibility that you're having this player who's done something bad be part of your group. You say, you go home right now, and once the investigation's played out, we'll make our decision. But I think that the fact he's taken that decision means that if it were to be a 10-game ban, even if you've got Acerbi eligible to play in the Euros, which he would be, because a 10-game ban for starters would only have one game left on it by the end of this season. There's 9 games left in the season, even if it did apply to the national team, which it wouldn't. But I think that suggests that he might then take a decision. If it was proven that Acerbi said these things, I think Spalletti might well take a decision that it's just not appropriate for you to be part of this group, even if you are not suspended.
And that's a huge thing, isn't it? Because he's an important player for them. And it would be sad as well, because, you know, he's a guy who's come through a lot in his career at quite an advanced stage of his career.
Testicular cancer.
To be important.
Someone who's been really viewed as like a role model. I think if he really said these things, it's one of the most almost heartbreakingly disappointing I would have feel towards a football player in ages. Because Acerbi has been someone who's had a lot of admiration and felt like he deserved a lot of admiration. I thought he was one of those figures that you felt like you could sort of pull for. And that changes a lot if he said what he said.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
We are on an international break here. The international conversation doesn't end. I didn't realise that we'd go for an under-23 conversation at this point, Andy, but this is quite an interesting one. It's another national team coach, albeit an under-23s coach, who has had, perhaps, an issue with one of the important players for France's under-23 team.
Well, under-21 and under-23, Thierry Henry is in charge of France's under-21 team, and he will be looking after the Olympic team, which normally an under-23s team in the Olympics, you just think, oh yeah. But of course, France are at home. The Olympics are in Paris. So this is a big deal. Of course, yeah. A lot of star players have come out and said, we want to be part of this. Now, Real Madrid have kind of pulled up the drawbridge to a certain extent because they've said this week, well, we don't have to let players go for the Olympics because it's not part of the agreed international windows. So you are not having any of our players. So Tchouameni won't play. Camavinga won't play. Presumably, if Kylian Mbappe signs for Real Madrid, that puts an end to his hopes that he's spoken about rather less boldly in recent weeks, presumably because he knows he's going to Real Madrid, of playing in the Paris Olympics. You know, for him to play in the Olympics in his home city would be amazing. Interestingly, just this week, Karim Benzema has put his hat in the ring. He said, oh, that would be fun. I would like to do it. And because
you're allowed a few...
You're allowed three over each player, yeah.
Okay.
So I think... because of what happened at the 2022 World Cup and the way that he pulled out and the dispute over the extent of his injury, Karim Benzema has had a weird international career. And it would feel like this would be quite a satisfying end to it, certainly for a lot of the French football public. Because if you look at a lot of the French football public, supporting public, and a lot of those players, those younger players in their early 20s particularly, who... play for France now, they idolise Benzema. They absolutely idolise him.
So you can see why.
Yeah, so for him to... because he came from the estates and became a superstar for Real Madrid. And that means a lot to people. And that means a lot to... especially coming from a North African background, that means a lot to a lot of non-white French footballers in particular. So for him to have some sort of, I guess, closure... would be interesting. The real question is, what does Thierry Henry think about it? Because Thierry Henry, who looks after the under-21 team and will be looking after the Olympic team, he's someone who's pretty forthright, as I'm sure will not be a surprise to anyone. Now, the interesting thing going into this international break is for the under-21s have got a couple of games. And Henry didn't pick Ryan Shirky of Lyon. 20 years old now, has been fated since he's 15 and 16. He's got incredible natural ability. He's not always looked like a completely mature footballer, I think it's fair to say. But Henry didn't pick him last week for the under-21 squad. And then Shirky's been struggling to get into the Lyon team as well, although he's been impeccable in recent times for the under-21s.
Season, though, relatively, isn't it?
For the under-21s, yes. For Lyon, not so much.
Okay.
And so he didn't get picked for this game at Toulouse on Friday night. Lyon are losing 2-1. Pierre Sage, the coach, brings on Shirky, and he says afterwards, I asked him, are you angry that he didn't get picked? Leaving open-ended by whether he meant, do I mean by me today,
right,
or not getting picked by Thierry Henry for the under-21s. Anyway, you asked Shirky, do you feel angry? And he said, yes, I feel angry. And he's like, right, well, go out and show me how angry you feel. And he goes out there, he scores a brilliant goal. He sets up the winner for Jake O'Brien, who's just received his first call for the Republic of Ireland team as well, and Lyon win the game. And Shirky talks about that afterwards, and he's quite eloquent, and he relays this story. And Henry responds, and he says, well, you know, it's fine for you to be angry, but you need to be more consistent. Now, he's ended up calling him back to the squad because Jorginho Rutter has pulled out of Leeds because he's injured. Yuri Shotar, the same of Montpellier, has pulled out. So Shirky is back in the squad.
But not with a ringing endorsement.
No, not really. And it is interesting that Henri has got this bluntness that is totally different from the way that Didier Deschamps has made some tough decisions. And, you know, he's been prepared to do that throughout his time in charge of France. But Henri, his bluntness is something different, and it's very public. And I just wonder how that works. If we're talking about him more globally as a coach, how does that work with star players as you get deeper into a coaching career?
I just think it depends, doesn't it? I think it's all about the mesh, because we were talking about him last week, weren't we? Zinedine Zidane is not exactly soft with his words. I mean, sometimes he's very softly spoken in terms of his volume, but he's not afraid to be blunt. Yeah. But there are settings in which that works and settings in which maybe it works less well. And I do wonder if, of course, bearing in mind who Henry is as a footballer, how intimidating that's got to be in some level as a young player for some footballers, quite how talented he was, quite what a footballer you're talking to, and being spoken down to could be quite a different effect to if you are, for instance, in the Real Madrid changing room and you're talking to someone who knows he's a superstar and is not going to be put off by having something negative said, or at least if they are going to be put off, is going to be able to handle it and internalize it in a different way. It's a difficult one.
Do you think that Thierry Henry has achieved his potential as a coach? Because we're talking about him as a footballer.
Yeah,
brilliant footballer, and the attitude towards a brilliant footballer. But what about as a coach? No, if you're Shirky, you're looking at him thinking, well, sorry, mate, you know, you got to work on yourself and all, haven't you?
I think he clearly hasn't achieved much yet in his coaching career. And I think that is, whether or not that would affect what a player thinks towards him, I'm not sure. But I do think, I don't know, Henri speaks so well about football on TV. There are some ex-pros who you listen to and you think, okay, you can talk about this game in a way that is, to people who haven't played the game professionally, really easy to understand and makes it very accessible, but also accessible in a way that's sophisticated. You can understand concepts because you can explain your concepts well. And the fact that you can do that makes me think you can coach. Like, you should be able to. But I do just think the dynamics of certain setups, certain clubs, certain national teams, certain groups of players are different. And whether or not this is the right way that to handle France under 21s right now is a question of its own.
I think it's interesting that the way that he's this combination between something quite modern, and you talk about the way he presents ideas on television, I agree, he's a really good pundit. Mm-hmm. And the like, if you talk to him, the way that he presents tactical concepts it's very detailed and it's very interesting. And it clearly has a very deep understanding of the game. But on the other hand, there's something quite old manish about him, I think. I mean, we saw that about when he was in charge of Monaco in that short and quite ill-fated spell. Now, Monaco didn't give him the best support. I think they were a bit of a mess as a club at the time. But there's that piece of footage that everyone, I'm sure, listening to this will be aware of him and a young player, I think it might be Benoit Badiachil, get up at a press conference, and Badiachil doesn't tuck his chair in. And he looks at him with like this death stare, like, what are you doing? Like, he doesn't need to ask him. He's like, come on, let's have a bit of respect. And to me, that's fascinating, this clash between this like new forward thinking and, well, in my day, we had to clean the older players' boots and all that sort of stuff. There's that sort of, you know, there must be complete discipline, which reflects the way that he and David Trezeguet and players like that were coached at Monaco when he was a kid, when they were super strict on discipline. So does that work at the biggest clubs? I'm not sure the biggest players take that, to be honest. I think they just go off and complain. And that is something you could argue is wrong about modern football. But I think whoever you are, whether you're Thierry Henry, whether you're Diego Simeone, it needs to be a certain type of player to take that. Now, you could argue that maybe that makes him better suited for age group coaching. You know, there's no doubt these players...
Or international versus club coaching, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
But I think particularly at this age, I think maybe speaking like that to senior players in the senior national team, maybe that doesn't work either.
It's like a Nigerian coach. Big club. You know, they think you're supposed to have respect for me. I'm older than you. And like, it doesn't work like that.
Definitely not with modern footballers, I think. And I think we can look at this and say, well, after he's like gone on a certain journey to try and become a coach at a good level, maybe this is a sort of demotion. This is not seen as a demotion in France. And he said that himself. You know, when France come calling, you can't say no. And also, the way that under 21 football is looked at there, it's like, this is absolutely vital for our future. Moulding these young players is a massive responsibility. And Shirky is kind of like that in microcosm, isn't he, really? Mm. Because he's someone, as we said, with extraordinary natural ability, who really, if we're being brutally honest, has produced very little now. And that game at Toulouse last week, that he comes on and like completely folds a game in 20 minutes is why he's so frustrating, because he can't do that on a regular basis. And actually, nothing that Thierry Henry has said about him is false or unreasonable.
Thierry Henry needs a good Olympics, doesn't he? He does need a good Olympics, because when you look at the trajectory of his, you know, when he started out as assistant to Roberto Martinez as Belgian coach, assistant Belgian coach, you thought, okay, I can see that. I can see the learning curve, as it were. Monaco didn't work out for him, fair enough, and you've alluded to perhaps why. But then going off to Montreal, you think, well, where does that... is that at best a sideways move? Whereas I can see the French under-21 team, and I can see that. That makes sense to me and is important if you're a national team manager at any level. But Montreal, was that kind of like...
Well, I can understand the cultural fit, but I just obviously COVID sort of cut that off and he felt quite isolated from his family. And so from a personal level, obviously you can understand why he came back. But I think where he goes next is really interesting, because as Nicky was already saying, he's great on television, like really, really good on television. And you're not in that sort of position that, say, Andy Gray was in the past, that thinks, well, I could earn loads of money and have a really quiet life. But the fact that he doesn't need to do this, you know, he's hugely wealthy. Everyone respects him in football anyway. He's got this incredible star
apart
quality.
Apart from in the island.
he's got this incredible star quality to him. And yet he's come back and done this because it's obviously something that burns inside him. He doesn't have to do it. Like, needs to do it.
Maybe this is the answer. He needs to go manage the Irish national team, take them to a major tournament, and that's how we heal.
I suspect that is not the answer, whatever the question was. That is not the answer. Okay, it's time for both of you to recommend a game of the week for us this weekend that we can enjoy, and obviously a food pairing to go with it as well. Got to eat.
Yeah, well, International Week. Interesting one. I was wondering if the game of the week should really just be one of the relatively few competitive ones like the qualifiers, but I haven't gone with that. I've gone with Spain-Brazil because it's Spain-Brazil, Dutton.
Of course.
So, why not? So that's the one I'm looking forward to. Spain, obviously.
Sorry to interrupt you, but just for the benefit of our listeners, I think Spain are catching Brazil at a good time.
Yeah, Brazil are really struggling, actually, in World Cup qualifying. It's funny because Andy was joking before about me picking one of Italy's two friendlies they've got coming up against Ecuador and Venezuela. And of course, I wasn't going to. But funnily enough, they're both ahead of Brazil in World Cup qualifying right now. Brazil are really having a tough run. Not seeing them at their highest ebb, but I think that's another reason why the game's fascinating. And obviously Spain are going to be one of the Euros favourites. So this is a pretty nice tune-up for them and fascinating to see where they're at. I know you will want a food pairing and...
Ochi doggy? Ochi doggy? That's what they eat, Brazilians. Ochi doggy. I think that's supposed to be a hot dog and they call it a ochi doggy.
Do you know what? I my mind's gone blank. I can't think what they're called, but I bet Andy's going to know. Because when I think about the one time I've been to Brazil, which was for the World Cup in 2014, the thing I remember is the little, I want to say pão de queijo. Is that right? The cheese bread.
Pão de queijo. Yeah.
Pão de queijo. That's it. The cheese bread is what I remember of the food. There's lots of good food over there, but that's what I remember. So that's what
can I
remember.
Can I just suggest that is an amateur's mistake in a churrascaria? They want you to fill up on that and not the meat.
Oh, see, but you're thinking about the churrascaria. My experience in Brazil was that I barely sat down anywhere because I was always on the move, going places and exploring. So it was just what you could grab and eat as you went.
You're not going to guilt me about having my favourite churrascaria while I was at the Brazilian World Cup. I feel fine about that. I feel fine with my decisions.
Fried plantain, always mm-hmm. a good bet in Brazil as well. Yeah, they do. They slice it the wrong way round, but yeah, it's nice. It's nice. I think.
Yeah, when you get up to Salvador, where you have that more sort of Caribbean African culture, you get good food
actually,
up there, don't you?
As an Italian, I should have brought in the absurd Italian
spaghetti.
The Brazilian pizzas. Brazil takes pizza to a whole different place.
Yes,
you're right.
Chocolate pizzas.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, let's go for that. Do you mind?
A Brazilian pizza with like chocolate spread and like 16 different kinds of candy on it. Sure, let's go with that one.
Maybe you save that for the dessert and you have mine for the main.
Well, what is yours? What's your football?
I mean, you've never told us if you commit to both of these food choices when it comes to the weekend.
Of course I do. Of course me.
Well, I'm going to go for Saturday evening. It's another old classic. France versus Germany in Lyon.
That's a proper classic.
Yeah, it is. And Germany have got some work to do before they host the Euros because that team's not in great nick. Manuel Neuer has pulled out after an injury in training. Jan-Nicolas Bester, someone who has been brilliant for Heidenheim this season, who I was really looking forward to seeing if he could make a late run for the Euros. First time he's been called up. Brilliant left foot. Really, really fine player. He fell through the cracks at the Dortmund Academy. He's had to pull out with a hamstring injury as well, which is disappointing. But they have to find some sort of personality, Germany. And they're doing it against the team who are probably the favourites to win the whole thing. So it'll be fascinating to see how this goes. In terms of food...
So just one question before we get to the food.
Yes.
Nagelsmann versus Deschamps. I imagine this is the first time that they've come up against each other. Nagelsmann's got a point to prove. Deschamps doesn't.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Deschamps is in a position of enormous power, despite the man who gave him his last contract extension, the president of the FFF, Noel Legrais, going. He's really got a strong relationship with Hubert Fournier, the former Lyon coach, who's the technical director. So Deschamps could not have his feet anymore under the desk, which, as we were saying last week, not great news to Zinedine Zidane, really, because that was one of his dreams. Nagelsmann, it's all about a short, sharp shock. It's what he can do in the short term, because I would expect to see him back in club football next season. But we've got to go to the food. And I think food-wise, if you're looking for street food in the Lyon region, you're looking at Andouillette, which is sausage made out of pig's intestines. Sometimes the whole thing, sometimes sort of ashe, like chopped up. Good in a bun. Actually, I probably shouldn't mention that. The best one I've seen done at football is at St Etienne, which is obviously like completely the rivals of Lyon. They also do great artisan burgers local to the ground. I'd recommend Ninkasi. Or fancy something a bit lighter, go down to the lake by Dessine and get yourself a bit of fresh fish and a salad.
Yeah, he knows his Lyon, does Bressel. Thank you for listening to On the Continent. Make sure that you join us again tomorrow for Ask OTC, where we'll be answering all of your questions about the latest news from the world of European football. And do make sure to subscribe in your podcast app so that you never miss an episode.
On the Continent is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know. And on my way around the duck.
So, if you fancy a sit down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster, and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.